Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue our analysis of Stephen Singular's book, Legacy of Deception. By the way, I have been mispronouncing the author's name. It was my privilege to interview Stephen Singular last Sunday evening, that being April 21st of 1996. That three-part interview, consisting of three half-hour segments, will be aired at the end of this particular series. Stephen Singular, again, wrote a book called Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. Singular is spelled just like the word, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R. And this book was published in softcover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. Stephen Singular's credentials are described on the backs as follows. Stephen Singular is a Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller, A Killing in the Family, and Charmed to Death. Stephen Singular was contacted by a source well-placed within the L.A. legal system and given information about the O.J. Simpson murder case, indicating that O.J. Simpson had been framed. Beyond that, there were indications that neo-Nazi or neo-Nazi-minded elements within the L.A. legal system may very well have been responsible for this. The source that Stephen Singular was contacted by specifically contacted him because of his work on the murder of Alan Berg by the neo-Nazi group called The Order. I don't actually like the term neo, but that is the prevailing terminology. The indications were that similar elements were within LAPD and that quite allegedly Mark Furman was of Nazi outlook, if not actual white supremacist organized participation, and the allegation was made, as many have alleged, that Mark Furman was involved with planting evidence. We should note for formal legal purposes that Mark Furman has not been charged with a crime, let alone convicted of one, and that there has been no objective legal finding in connection with Mark Furman or any other member of LAPD. Indeed, I don't think it's particularly important which detectives or which cops helped to frame O.J. Simpson. There also certainly appear to have been people within the criminologist's office or within the coroner's office that also were engaged in framing O.J. Simpson, as we shall see. Indeed, I think at this stage of the game, the identities of the real murderers themselves are not important. What is important is to understand this very important political event for what it was, and indeed I think the real blame for this obscene event lies with society as a whole. And although I certainly do not condone police officers or officers of Nazi outlook, or perhaps even Nazi officers with a capital N and a capital O here, framing anybody for murder, and I certainly don't sanction people being murdered, whoever it was who actually did the killings, the real blame for this obscene event in which an obviously innocent man was framed lies with society as a whole. Author Edith Wharton had a saying that, quote, "A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys." And I think that applies in no uncertain terms to the O.J. Simpson case, whoever the actual identities of the real killers and the people who framed O.J. Simpson were. Indeed, it appears that white supremacist or white supremacist-minded elements within the L.A. legal system were implicated in the O.J. case. Hence, again, Singular's source contacting him for his outlet for this information, or her outlet. It's not clear who Singular's source was. We're going to take a look now at information that was given to Stephen Singular about switching some swatches, some cotton swabs that had O.J. Simpson's blood on them, and Stephen Singular's source communicated to him the possibility that swatches that had been deliberately dipped in O.J.'s blood were switched for swatches that were from the crime scene, this done to implicate O.J. Simpson. Turning to Legacy of Deception by Stephen Singular, we read, "After O.J. returned from Chicago on June 13th, he was taken into custody and blood was drawn from his arm," unquote. This quoting O.J.'s Singular source. "Correct." Actually, this is quoting Singular himself. "Correct," Douglas replied sharply. "That's the first thing you've said that I know is true," unquote. Douglas here, by the way, is Carl Douglas, one of O.J.'s defense attorneys. Quote, "I've been told that his drawn blood was then stored in a vial that contains a preservative." Pavlik nodded, and Douglas repeated, "A preservative?" "Yes, I've been told that some of the blood, which the LAPD says they picked up at the crime scene, will turn out to be O.J.'s blood. It will contain his DNA." We suspect that's right, Douglas said, and I've been told that a test conducted on this blood will prove that it could not have come out of his body on the night of the crime. How could it prove that, Douglas said? Traces of a preservative will show up in the blood that's been stored in this type of vial. I paused and then added, as far as I can tell, that is the only provable thing in this case. Pavlik made another sarcastic sound. By the way, Pavlik is Bill Pavlik, a former L.A. cop who was serving as a chief investigator for the Simpson defense team. Anything else? Douglas prompted. I was told that after the blood was drawn from O.J.'s arm, someone got a hold of the vial, extracted blood from it with a syringe, went back to the crime scene and perhaps to O.J.'s estate, and sprinkled some of this blood around. I was told that just enough blood was used to make Simpson look guilty, but not enough to make it look as if the blood had obviously been planted. Certain police detectives, I was told, are very clever at doing these kinds of things and at covering their tracks, unquote. And still more about the alleged switching of the swatches. Now, this again concerns the alleged switching of these cotton swabs with O.J.'s blood for cotton swabs that were taken from the crime scene. And quoting here, the person quoted here, of course, is the is Stephen Singular's source. Actually, the source quoted here is Stephen Singular in a conversation once again with Carl Douglas. All right, I'm going to tell you something, and I want you to look into it. I have reason to believe that an underling in the crime lab was told to put some of O.J.'s stored blood from that purple-capped vial on some clean swatches before they were sent off to the Cellmark Diagnostics Lab in Maryland for DNA testing. I have reason to believe that this person was told to do this by a superior and was told that it was part of standard operating procedure so that Cellmark would have something to compare with the blood swatches that were picked up at the crime scene. This underling may have thought that this wasn't quite right, and he told someone about it. That someone contacted me. I was supposed to meet with him, but then he backed out at the last moment. The person I'm looking for may be a young criminalist who handled these swatches and then dotted them with blood in the crime lab. I'm told that he's now fearful for his job and his career, unquote. Are you saying that they put stored blood on clean swatches and then let Cellmark test those swatches for O.J.'s DNA? That's what I've heard. So that the test had to come back saying that O.J.'s blood was found at the crime scene? Correct. This blood would also have preservative in it, Carl. Correct. Anything that came out of that vial is tainted, and you can prove that. I hear you. So you have to run that test. Now, by the way, this conversation obviously is between Stephen Singular and Carl Douglas, again using information that Singular got from his source within LAPD, within the LA legal system. It's not clear whether it was a cop or who it was. Whoever it was highly placed and had access to information from a number of different corridors within the Los Angeles legal system. And skipping down in this particular passage, we should note that Barry Scheck, one of O.J.'s DNA lawyers, pressed Judge Ito to force the prosecution to turn over some crime scene blood swatches for testing. Skipping down, that same day, Barry Scheck, the DNA lawyer who'd recently spoken to Dr. Ambruso about the anticoagulant EDTA, also appeared in court and demanded that Judge Ito force the prosecution to turn over some crime scene blood swatches to the defense team so they could do their own testing. Scheck implied that the prosecutors were using stall tactics to keep the defense from receiving these swatches. He told the court that he wanted the swatches so they could be examined for contamination. And again, I would note that Judge Ito was married to Captain Peggy York, the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD and Furman's former watch commander. One of the things that I found very unsatisfactory during the course of the trial was Judge Ito's rulings consistently made in favor of the prosecution rather than the defense. Although I think Judge Ito was certainly under a great deal of pressure in this case, I personally was not at all satisfied with his performance. And indeed, I wonder about the possibility of a conflict of interest for Judge Ito. Still more about the EDTA question. Now, bear in mind that O.J.'s blood sample was put in a type of vial which contains EDTA. There are three types of vials used by forensics laboratories around the country. Each has a different color-coded cap and a different type of preservative. The O.J. blood sample was put in a purple-capped vial that has EDTA as a preservative. In the passage I'm about to read, as you will see, once again, Barry Scheck raises the question of the possibility of the prosecution, deliberately stalling in order to prevent the defense from performing the requisite test, the gas chromatography test for EDTA. Later on in this series, we're going to take a look at the defense's own questionable behavior. It would appear that they could have done a much better job of defending O.J. Simpson, including going for the EDTA tests much earlier than they did. Nonetheless, the case did have the appearance of deliberate delays on the part of the prosecution. And again, please note that Judge Ito was less than sympathetic to the defense. Skipping down in Legacy of Deception by Stephen Singular, we read, "In almost every instance when a motion was being argued in open court, the judge ruled against Simpson's lawyers. After observing yet another loss for Cochran, Shapiro, Douglas, Ullman and Company, one TV commentator shook his head and said, 'Saddam Hussein had a better track record in the Gulf War than the defense has had in front of this judge.'" Unquote. On Thursday, October 6th, Barry Scheck came to court and argued that with the prosecution's Lisa Kahn about the DNA evidence that would be presented at the trial. Scheck told the judge that the defense wanted to see not just the results of the DNA tests the prosecution had run, but also the, quote, underlying data, unquote, on those tests. Kahn said she'd never heard of such a request before. Referring to the prosecution's refusal to turn over to the defense some crime scene blood swatches for further testing, Scheck declared that, quote, "They have stalled and delayed on all of this. We're never going to get a shot at the DNA. That's what's going on here," unquote. He asked the judge for swatch number 48, adding that he wanted to be allowed into the prosecution's testing lab in order to look for signs of, quote, contamination, unquote, of the blood. Near the end of the argument, Kahn told the judge that swatch number 47 was now available for the defense to test. Scheck announced that he wanted to, quote, break new ground, unquote, in the blood tests the defense would conduct. Hearing this, Kahn rolled her eyes and looked incredulous. In the next passage of Legacy of Deception that we're going to look at, we're going to examine Judge Ito's ruling that the FBI should perform the requisite tests for EDTA. And again, one of the things I have questions about in this case, and one of the reasons why I do not dismiss the possibility of the O.J. case as a psychological operation, a type of domestic intelligence operation, concerns the possible role of the FBI in some of the criminal findings. Again, I think there is a lot more research on the O.J. Simpson case that has yet to be done. From Legacy of Deception, we read the following. "As with many other things in this case, the lawyer's words did not clarify anything. Rather, they only muddied up the issue further. After listening to them argue at length, one was not at all certain which side had already done what with the blood samples or what might happen with them in the future. The judge, who had seemingly been unaware of EDTA until now, was very interested in having the samples tested and getting the results. He wanted the FBI to oversee the tests." And as we shall see, when these tests were performed, Judge Ito refused to allow the defense to perform their own tests. They could only look at the blood samples, but not test them themselves. Again, I was not at all satisfied with Judge Ito's role in this particular case. It appeared to me that he was unnecessarily hard on the defense, and I believe that had much to do with coloring the case in the way that it did. As we shall see, I think the defense was far from blameless in this case as well, and the prosecution was far from blameless. Indeed, as I've indicated, I think that the real criminals in this case were the society as a whole, regardless of the identities of the police and or criminalists who helped to frame O.J. Simpson, regardless of the identities of the real killer or killers, and I suspect there was more than one. I think the real villains here were, the real villain was the society as a whole, and I will talk more about that later on in the series. Of the EDTA tests and Judge Ito's ruling that they should be, these tests should be performed by the FBI, Barry Scheck reminded the judge that his side had done its own blood testing last fall and had no obligation whatsoever to turn over to the prosecution what they learned from evidence samples 47, 50, and 78. They would present their findings in the future, Scheck said, when they put on their case. After days of legal wrangling, Judge Ito ruled that the prosecution could test the blood on the gate and the blood on the socks under the supervision of the FBI. The judge announced to the courtroom that a gas chromatography test, the same test Dr. Ambruso had told me about 6 months earlier, and the same test I described to Carl Douglas in a fax last September, seemed to be in order now. According to Ito's ruling, the defense would be given the opportunity only to look at portions of the blood samples, not to test them. If the defense tampered with these samples in any way or misplaced them, the judge said, he would hit Simpson's team with severe sanctions. And one of the aspects concerning the blood on the back gate was why the police and the criminologists had waited so long to remove that blood sample from the back gate, or to take the test. As we shall see, the crime scene was broken down extraordinarily quickly, and yet the blood from the condo's back gate was not picked up till almost 3 weeks after the killings. The killings were committed on the evening of June 12, 1994. The blood on the back gate was collected on July 3rd, after the crime scene was broken down. Singular writes about this, saying, late that afternoon, the cross-exam slowly became more interesting when Cochran asked Detective Lang why the officers had broken down the crime scene so early on. Why had they removed the yellow tape surrounding 875 South Bundy at 3:45 p.m. on June 13th? Hadn't they acted too quickly? Hadn't they opened this location up too fast so that anyone could have walked through it and picked up blood on their shoes or hands? Couldn't someone have transported that blood over to Simpson's home or to the interior of his Bronco? Shouldn't more of the blood at Bundy have been collected by the crime lab technicians and then tested? When was the victim's blood washed off the condo's pavement? Was it possible that the washed-away blood might have told us something critical about these murders, something that now would never be known? These were excellent questions, and Lang had trouble answering many of them satisfactorily. Wasn't it true, Cochran wanted to know, that the blood collected by criminalist Dennis Fung from the condo's back gate had been picked up on July 3, 1994, a full 3 weeks after Ron and Nicole had been killed? How reliable was that piece of evidence, which the prosecution was now testing for the presence of EDTA? Why hadn't this blood been gathered much earlier, before the crime scene had been broken down? Isn't that the way a homicide investigation is supposed to be conducted? Indeed, I think those are very important questions. As we shall see, when the EDTA evidence came out in court, even the prosecution's information was ambiguous at best. The first aspect of the EDTA testimony we're going to deal with concerns an expert on EDTA, Dr. Frederick Readers, who was called by the defense. On July 24th, the defense called Dr. Frederick Readers, R-I-E-D-E-R-S, an expert in forensic toxicology. Readers had not actually tested any of the blood for traces of EDTA, but he'd had access to the data that had been produced following the blood tests run last February by the FBI. Readers had first analyzed EDTA in 1954 and began doing gas chromatography tests in 1959. A heavy-set, short-tempered man from Pennsylvania, he clearly conveyed to trial observers that he did not enjoy having any part of his authority challenged. The two blood samples the FBI had examined were taken from the back gate at Nicole's condo and from a pair of socks found in Simpson's bedroom following the crimes. The FBI had employed a testing method that involved separating EDTA from the rest of the blood. The anticoagulant would, as Dr. Readers explained to the jurors, quote, go for a walk by itself, unquote. The test results from the blood on the socks, Dr. Readers said, offered, quote, the strongest possible presence of EDTA, unquote, given the current technology that exists to detect and measure such things. A negative control, he added, had already been used by the FBI in one of the experiments. This control, he testified, quote, reasonably certainly rules out the presence of laundry detergent, unquote, on the socks as having been the source of the EDTA. In other words, he believed that a preservative was found on the socks because that blood had come out of the purple-capped vial holding O.J. Simpson's stored blood. And skipping down, we will now get to Marcia Clark's cross-examination of Readers. And again, the interesting questions about just what exactly the FBI's role was in this particular case. Marcia Clark had done her homework on EDTA and the science surrounding it. She vigorously cross-examined Dr. Readers, asking him why Special Agent Roger Martz, M-A-R-T-Z, the FBI scientist who'd done this testing, had found as much EDTA in his own unpreserved blood sample as he'd found in the socks. Martz's blood, Clark argued, had never been stored in a vial, yet it held the same anticoagulant as some of the blood evidence in this case. How could the witness explain this? Dr. Readers testified that this simply could not be true because unstored blood did not have that much EDTA in it. If Agent Martz's blood had revealed this much of the anticoagulant, Readers explained, that not only would be unnatural, it would put the man's life in danger. The next day, Agent Martz himself took the stand. He testified that he'd been contacted by the prosecution in February of 1995 when they'd written him a letter asking him to run these tests, quote, in order to refute, unquote, that the blood in question could have come from Nicole's or O.J. Simpson's stored blood samples. This letter set off a firestorm in the courtroom because it seemed to support the long-standing defense position that the FBI had brought in not to run an objective test for EDTA, but to disprove the notion that blood could have been taken from a vial and planted. The letter, the defense argued, spelled out the mindset that had driven the prosecution since the very beginning of the case. The only relevant evidence was evidence that implicated O.J. Simpson. Anything that might have exonerated him was either thrown away or ignored. Defense lawyer Robert Blasier, B-L-A-S-I-E-R, got Agent Martz to acknowledge to the jury that he'd never tested for EDTA before. Blasier also attacked Martz's credibility because the FBI had not used gas chromatography in its testing, which Blasier claimed was the best method for finding EDTA. While being questioned by the defense, Martz told the court that the results of his work, carried out in an FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia, had been, quote, misinterpreted, unquote. He said he'd found no EDTA in one test, but in another he'd found something that might have, quote, been consistent with, unquote, EDTA, yet he wasn't sure. The compound he'd found, he testified, had never been properly identified. When Marcia Clark cross-examined Martz, he changed his mind and said he definitely detected no EDTA on the back of the condo or on the socks retrieved from Simpson's bedroom. These stains, he declared, unquote, again quoting, did not come from preserved blood, unquote. But Martz also said that what he'd found in his own blood and had labeled EDTA might not have been the anticoagulant after all. As with many other aspects of the trial, this one was utterly confusing. How any jury could have made sense of the testimony of Martz was beyond me. The most perceptive question I heard from the media commentators who spoke about this issue concerned why the defense had not taken one of the blood samples they'd been given last fall and run their own tests for the preservative. Why had they relied on an FBI agent who seemed completely unfamiliar with the science of testing blood for EDTA? Indeed, I think that there are some interesting questions raised here about the defense's performance. We're going to talk later on about the failures of all sides in this particular case. It appears that the information that Stephen Singular was given was basically accurate, and nobody, the defense, neither the defense nor the prosecution nor the media, wanted to look into this. We will have more to say about that a little later on. And again, I am not necessarily casting aspersions on Agent Martz. He had not tested for EDTA in the past, and indeed, I think his own results were open to interpretation by either side in this case. That is to say, a favorable interpretation by either side in this case. It is indeed sad that the defense did not test for EDTA, and indeed, I think some of the testimony regarding EDTA indeed indicates that the blood had been planted, the blood on the socks. I think, though, once again, that there is failure enough all around in this particular case. I think the defense failed, the prosecution failed, the media failed, the police failed, the criminologists failed, and beyond that, I think this case exemplifies a failure on the part of American democracy and American criminal law. I think one of the very few people who didn't fail in connection with this case was Stephen Singular. Stephen Singular's source also indicated to him that the blood that was in the Bronco was also suspect. Turning to Legacy of Deception once again, we read, I asked him about the blood smears on the console in Simpson's Bronco. All the blood in the Bronco is suspect, he said. What do you mean? You should question every bit of it. How did it get in there? I don't know how it got on the console, but I can tell you a few things and you can draw your own conclusions. Don't you find it curious that if the four detectives who went to Simpson's home at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock on the morning of June 13th, wanted a good and very plausible excuse for jumping O.J.'s defense without a search warrant, they would have mentioned these bloodstains? What if they didn't see them? It was still fairly dark outside. You saw pictures of the smears, didn't you? Yes. Didn't they seem pretty obvious to you? Much more obvious than the tiny speck of blood that Furman said he saw on the outside of the truck. Are you saying that the smears appeared on the Bronco later? At the preliminary hearing, did Furman testify about seeing those smears? No. Did Van Atter? No. Did anyone else? Not to my knowledge. Has anyone talked to the people in the LAPD fingerprint shed? The truck was taken there after it was hauled away from Simpson's home. What about the print shed? Ask Douglas if he's talked to the people who work there. What would that show? Ask the print shed employees if they saw all that blood in the vehicle when they tested the Bronco for fingerprints. You are saying that the stains were placed there later? Draw your own conclusions. If that's the truth, how did the blood get in there? We know that the Bronco was broken into at least once after it was taken to the impound yard at Viertel's, that's V-I-E-R-T-E-L. It's entirely possible that it was broken into again, and that's when the smears were placed on the console. Did Furman do this? I have no information about that, but it would probably have been too risky for him. Did another detective do it? I really don't know. As we shall see, testimony came out in the trial supporting the contention that the blood was planted in the Bronco. Turning once again to Legacy of Deception, on July 20th, after the defense had begun putting on its own evidence, Chris Darden got one more thing to think about. LAPD Detective Kelly Muldorfer, M-U-L-L-D-O-R-F-E-R, testified that she'd seen no blood smears on the console of Simpson's Bronco several days after the murders when she'd looked inside the vehicle at the impound yard at Viertel's. Others would testify to the same thing, including John Meraz, M-E-R-A-Z, a tow truck operator who admitted breaking into the truck after it had been impounded. Meraz was not a very credible witness, but Detective Muldorfer was. And as we shall see, Robert Shapiro, in questioning Detective Van Atter, also brought out some inconsistencies vis-a-vis the blood in the Bronco. F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran had come into the trial with larger reputations as criminal lawyers, but Shapiro was more focused than either of them. He'd taken boxing lessons and asked questions like a fighter throwing jabs. Boom, boom, boom. He had the next punch ready right after the last one had landed. He badgered Van Atter over why, on the afternoon of June 13th, the detective had transported Simpson's blood from downtown all the way to the defendant's residence. And skipping down, more about Shapiro's examination of Detective Van Atter. Had Van Atter himself seen blood on the console of the Bronco on the day after the murders? Yes, he had. Then why hadn't he written that in his first police report on the case? He, that of course is Van Atter, fumbled for an answer. By the time he left the stand, the detective looked edgy enough to throw a punch of his own. Now, this, again, is non-definitive, just as the fact that Van Atter took the blood back to O.J.'s house is non-definitive. It raises more questions than it answers, but those questions have never been properly answered. We will attempt to do that later on in our series. This concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.